Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco.
The regular cast.
It has been a long time since I've said that, and I think listeners with keen ears who either listen in nice headphones or in a loud car where it matters will notice that we are back to the old recording rig. I'm sure there's a difference in the way I sound. I'm just not sure how to quantify it. Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of the shows. We actually have a growing list of podcasts, including the, I think the only 5 week old at this point, Outlaw God podcast, which I co-host with Steve Paulson. You go to 1517.org/outlawgod to check that podcast out. The podcast is one piece, commentary on Luther's Bondage of the Will, one piece exegesis, one piece Lutheran systematic theology, and it mostly ends in interesting conversations. It's actually a little shorter than the Thinking Fellows. As we've moved forward with the podcasting network, we found that when people drive, they really do only make it through about 30 minutes before they have to pick back up. So if you want somebody to listen to everything you have to say, best way to do that is to shoot for around 30 minutes. So if you have lower time commitments or your drive to work is shorter, it's a great podcast for that as well. All right, guys. So today we're going to do a topic that sometimes we shy away from. Other times we don't shy away from. We've done little bits of it here and there. But we'll just talk about the idea of church and state. In the United States, we are used to the phrase separation of church and state. Sometimes that's highly debated as a good or a bad thing from both sides, actually, as well. You would, even with some what we would call classically non-religious people, you're starting to see an element of spirituality or inserted into politics. And one of the reasons we shy away from this is because...
That's funny. Can I relate our breakfast this morning?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So we drove in early this morning because I had to drop my truck off at 8 a.m. at the dealer to get it. The dealer had to tell the computer in my truck to behave. So we drop it off. We go to breakfast, and we're sitting at breakfast. And
yeah,
one of the guys that works there is recounting his morning ritual, and he's... We've gone to breakfast there quite a few times. He's a very nice guy, very decent guy, but it's kind of obvious that he's not a believer.
No.
But as he recounts his morning ritual, he begins by saying, well, every morning I wake up and I meditate for an hour. and I thought to myself, I mean, oh, Lord, if I had the discipline to even pray for an hour every morning.
Right.
And I believe in this stuff.
Right.
And, goodness knows what he believes in, and yet he's got the discipline to pray for an hour. And there has been developed, and I think you notice it more and more with what's going on politically, a very secular religious mindset, that even down to practicing spiritual disciplines that aren't intrinsically spiritual, right?
Right. Hmm. Now, one of the reasons we shy away from this is because when it comes to each role people play on this group of Thinking Fellows, Rod usually plays the risk management department.
Which is funny.
And so he advises us to be careful about topics like this. And I just thought I would throw it to you to maybe explain why you give that advice and what you're weary of when people who primarily do theology start talking about politics.
Well, one of the reasons is very simple. That is, in how many parishes do you find the gospel clearly and simply preached every Sunday? And it's frightening, I think, how low that percentage is. So in a way, it's what do we have time for if the gospel isn't central?
Right.
I'm glad Luther had to deal with it. I'm glad we've got it in our history. But like so many other important topics, I want 1517 to be known for helping guys to do the gospel clearly and well. That's a pretty pragmatic approach to it, but I'm worried about American Christianity.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, we've had, I'll say at least, a certain amount of criticism for not, maybe publicly standing on the quote-unquote right side of political issues. All over the spectrum, right? Sometimes people on the right think we should have said more against this or that, and people on the left think we should have said more in support of this or that. And we typically don't. But I think one of the things that could come out, hopefully, of an episode like this is to reiterate Rod's perspective, which is, I mean, clearly, that the gospel is not, you know, in its pure sense, preached in all churches.
Right? No.
I mean, if you travel around to churches much at all, you'll see that.
Well, and we could even say that there's probably a higher chance that you'll hear something about political. American politics
yes.
from a pulpit in the U.S. today
yeah.
than Christ crucified for you
right.
being proclaimed.
Right.
Yeah, that is of paramount importance. That's why 1517 exists. It doesn't exist to talk about politics. But I think even just for sort of reiterating, you know, the necessity of this sort of separation and why, you know, the pulpit and preaching is reserved for first order things. It's reserved for preaching Christ and Him crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. And that many other things that we want to work their way into the pulpit ought not to.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, this is an interesting and probably in some ways, I'm not going to overplay this because I think so many people are overplaying it, historical time right now where you have sort of a convergence of a lot of really odd things going on. You know, you have the pandemic, you have the, shall we say, interesting governmental response to the pandemic. You have, you know, issues of police brutality and possible reforms and governmental reforms that are being proposed in this. And all of these in our day and age are spoken of as ultimate ethical issues, right, that need to be addressed by ethical people. And, you know, for us to say, well, we don't talk about that is maybe not enough. Now, I think we can stand on the if we take a side on any of these issues, it's sort of incidental, right?
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, if somebody takes a side on any of these issues in the show, you're hearing one man's opinion. You're not necessarily hearing somebody say, this is what I believe, and if you don't believe it, you need to be canceled or something like that.
Right.
You know, you're just saying, this is what I think is prudent. But at the same time, I know there are people in churches out there everywhere who want some help sort of working through this. I'm not sure that what we say is going to be exactly what they're looking for, because my guess is that it will be less prescriptive
right.
Than what they want.
Yep. So. you take a short study back into what has come to be called church and state, and you find out that even the secular discussion ain't that great. The core of it was these people had come from England, and I think the core of it was there's going to be no Church of England here under the name Church of America.
Right.
I think it was basic.
Yeah.
I have a heck of a time getting that across to liberal friends, because the issue has been used so broadly that I think it has very little relationship to what was going on at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's used in a way that says, if you have religious concerns, or let's say religion informs decisions you make politically and ethically, you actually have to stay quiet about those.
Right.
Or you have to act like you're not a practitioner of that religion before you make political decisions. And that's bogus.
It is. Yeah. Thank you.
It's also, we happen to have a historian here with us today. It's also, I think, bogus to say that within Lutheranism that there was always a sort of sharp line distinction between the function of the church and the function of the government or the state or the principalities at the time. Well, there wasn't, and they just, you know, they were more interlocked than most Americans would be comfortable with on either side.
Yeah, I mean, this is maybe one of the areas. Why, like Lutherans, if you were to have a Lutheran perspective on this and you were going to go back to the Magisterial Reformation, talk about it, and you live in the U.S., it's hard, right? Because our political climate is nothing like Lutheran in Wittenberg, right? Adam, what's it look like in Wittenberg for Luther compared to...
Well, they're living in an empire that conceives of itself as Corpus Christianum, the body of Christians, or Christendom.
Yep.
and Luther's two kingdom doctrine, or the two kingdom doctrine in the Reformed tradition, is articulated in that particular context. It's to take the two kingdom doctrine and lift it out of its historical context and put it in an American context leads to all sorts of problems, like you just noted.
Especially politically.
In particular, because it's people will interpret two kingdoms in light of Thomas Jefferson's personal letter where he says there's a wall of separation
between
church and state. Or what you'll find in Lutheran traditions, like in universities, sometimes the two kingdom doctrine is appealed to suggest that anything outside of everything outside of theology is completely autonomous from faith, religion, and so on. So you can arrive at conclusions that contradict. It's like that old double truth doctrine from the Middle Ages. You can arrive at conclusions that are radically different than the conclusions you arrive at in the theological discipline, and they're both true.
Yeah.
And the more liberal Lutheran traditions have followed that trajectory. I mean, such that I don't know how many ELCA colleges there are these days, but
there are zero.
they're all secular.
They're all secular.
And I mean, I don't know what the scene is in the LCMS so much, but it's not that bad, certainly. But I've encountered like individuals who will advocate for a complete separation of the sacred from the secular, such that you can't even really talk to each other.
Yeah.
Again, it's the idea that you leave your faith at the doorstep when you start doing political things.
Do you think, Adam, it's fair to say that understood properly, two kingdom informs the individual Christian? And within sort of Luther's context, since they did see themselves as within Christendom, when the individual Christian happened to be the emperor or the elector, then they had the power to enact that themselves. But within our context of, I don't want to say this stark separation, although I believe in it in the American context, but that the two kingdoms informs us individually and vocationally, how we act and participate in the kingdom of right, which is the kingdom of the gospel, is to receive God's word and to receive the gifts of his sacraments, and how we participate in the left is vocational in nature, in that we are called to be various things to other people.
The ancient Lutherans would acknowledge that the coinage in the kingdom of the left is reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how God rules the right-hand kingdom through his word.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The left-hand kingdom through reason and all the first
principalities.
Article gifts.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we could say that the distinction between the two kingdoms is an affirmation of the idea that God works through means, and then the distinction is what the means are. So in the right-hand kingdom, we would call those the means of grace, the proclaimed word and
the
baptism,
gifts of the
Lord's supper. Yeah. In the kingdom of the right, that means is action, the sword. Luther references the sword as a means of...
Well, Paul does, Romans 13.
All the time. Kingdom of the left. Yes, the sword... political action, and we could even say the vocation of individuals within that civil realm, whether you are a magistrate or a citizen or in the United States, then that vocational aspect maybe is a little more blurred than in Luther's time because citizens play a more political role or something.
Well, this is what I was getting at, is that, but there's a, and please, I mean, if I'm going down the wrong path here, I need to be corrected because I'll be teaching this to a bunch of high schoolers pretty soon. Vocationally, you have a role as a citizen, right? And to your other neighbors, we are also called citizens, which means that politically, you need to use your reason, right? And your sense of what is right and wrong to guide your civic actions.
Yes.
It might be voting.
Yes.
Following the law, the laws as they're given down to you from the authorities.
Disobeying the law? No.
Well, yeah. Maybe. I mean, look at Bonhoeffer on this stuff. Maybe. But at the same time, that is not necessarily something that comes to you from the church.
Correct.
And I think this is where the confusion comes in. I think the church can teach you about what God says is right and wrong, but then sort of you vocationally enact that through your reason and your civic actions.
Yep.
So here's the... No
issues with that.
Okay.
I mean, now, jumping back a little bit, it's interesting, this kind of misperception of the two-kingdom doctrine. You find it even in the Founding Fathers. It was either... I'm pretty sure it was James Madison.
He was.
Who in a... I think it was a speech at a dedication of a church attributes the separation clause in the First Amendment to Martin Luther. But here's the kicker, though. So you've got the First Amendment, there's a separation or non-establishment clause. That's what I mean. Sorry.
We should go over that too. I'm going to just make a mental note there. Go ahead.
Well, while you have that's law in America. You have in the early republic, you still have state churches. I think Massachusetts had
individual states.
The latest
is what you're saying.
Yeah. So it was the federal government,
not state like as a global state, i.e., federal government.
Right.
You're talking about individual states had churches. You know, Massachusetts wasn't or whatever.
Like Dr. Rosenblatt said earlier, there is, I mean, the not to a person, but most of the colonists were absolutely opposed to having some sort of bishop from the Church of England in the colonies. There were almost, not all of them, again, but they're committed, what we might call congregationalists.
So when you clarified the separation clause as the non-establishment clause, and I think this is what Rod was getting at here, is that the only, at least initially as sort of understood, maybe not as later defined by the courts or something like that, but the initial intent seems to be to simply not establish a particular religion that you must be a part of.
Yep.
In order to be a citizen of, you know, the republic that was the United States.
Yep.
Now this, the thing, I think where we get in trouble is this doesn't actually inform a whole lot.
No.
it's like I said, this is sort of not going to be super prescriptive on our part, because that doesn't even inform a whole lot. That doesn't mean that your pastor, just all things being equal, can't preach on something political.
Right. Well, I mean, there's political issues in the United States, which we certainly would say overlap with the doctrine of sin, right?
Well, just even think of it this way: we're just talking about what the Constitution affords, right? This doesn't mean that your pastor can't preach on something political. Now, we might say that confessionally and scripturally they ought to preach on the gospel, right? But the state can't stop them from preaching something political in that sense. Nor does that mean that an individual senator can't express a religious opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Nor would it even mean that, you know, certain maybe municipalities can't post some religious icon or something like that. I mean, this is where I think this gets all balled up, is that I feel like we try to ascribe more meaning to this than is actually given to us in the non-establishment clause itself.
Yeah, let me throw another wrench in the cogs.
Yeah.
One thing that really irritates me is this sort of assumption that those secularists are completely neutral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was Roy Clauser, I think he was a Reformed thinker, the book, The Myth of Religious Neutrality, and it's this massive tome on the presumption or the arrogant presumption that, you know, like you said earlier, Caleb, if you have an opinion, if there's a political question and you're going to answer from a religious point of view, you're not allowed.
And particularly
as if the Christian, secular viewpoints aren't nowadays religious in nature.
Oh, sorry.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
We were talking
even just epistemologically religious in nature. In other words, based on something that's not verifiable. You know, this isn't like hard evidence. It's kind of what kind of bugs me about even the response of politicians saying, you know, well, science will determine X, Y, or Z. I'm like, what does that mean? It's as though science is God, you know, that lives somewhere out there, and only you have access to the special information he's handing down, and then you're going to give it to us.
Yeah, if you're a believing Christian, it's very clear you're not welcome to the square, the conversation in the square. This, I think, would have horrified the founders. It's horrified.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, noting today before we were recording that there are times where, you know, if somebody expresses a political opinion who's a Christian and it's clearly informed by their faith, and then somebody else expresses a similar political opinion in their a Muslim, oftentimes you'll hear an excuse made for the Muslim that's something like, well, that's part of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of their culture. That's organic to them.
Yeah, they get a pass.
To their experience. Christians, nope, that's just your system of oppression on other people.
Yeah.
How does that work out? My religion's older. It's been part of the culture for a longer period of time.
Yeah, and it's certainly been part of your culture your entire life.
Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that is interesting here is that I think what a lot of people want is for one of their sort of religious authorities to tell them exactly how they should vote.
Yeah.
And maybe that could be a good thing in some circumstances, but it seems like we can only experience this from sort of the era and the place, era in which we live and the place where we live, right? And that's here in the United States in 2020. And for good or ill, you get to make those decisions on your own. And I think that's what sort of gets tricky. And one of the scariest things that I personally see happening right now in all this is just so many people running around looking to be told exactly what to do without, kind of as Rod alluded to, even wanting the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, at the risk of getting us in a lot of trouble, the mask thing is driving me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is. And it's not that I think there's zero evidence that wearing a mask will reduce the rate at which spittle from projects from my mouth to a certain distance, because I think that's a real possibility, right? But one, I'm not really being given the data on it when I'm told to wear it. I'm just told to wear it.
I mean,
right?
To be fair, you exile yourself from all forms of digital media and online presence, so I don't know where you'd get the media.
But then you see people like in their cars by themselves wearing it, and you think you're... you know,
okay, with no other passengers.
Yeah, just
too. Yeah. No,
I just think, you know, this is, there's so many things that are just happening because the priest told people that this should happen, and I think, you know, the priest has been. I just did a YouTube video with Bruce Hillman on postmodernism. Been doing a bunch of them that make me want to harm myself, but at the same time, you know, it's interesting because he either plays devil's advocate really, really, really well. And or freaks me out because he believes a lot of it. I can't tell which one it is at the moment. I think he's playing devil's advocate really well. But you get sort of the deconstructive roots of a lot of what's going on now, just blaring. One of the things we talked about on that was this Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone.
Mm-hmm. In Washington State,
six-block area that protesters have essentially taken over. Kicked out the police and other authorities. There's some ironies, you know, to the fact that I think a lot of these people would have been very much opposed to Trump's wall, and the first thing they did was construct a wall. That's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, I don't care what side of the wall thing you fall on. That's just kind of funny. You know, and then they set up their own police chief who is armed and walks around with an AK-47 enforcing their laws, you know, and people can be ejected from this space for not adhering to the code. And what I told Bruce is, I said, this is funny because this is like the ultimate expression of postmodern deconstructionism, right? We're going to kick out all the authorities. I don't think they kicked out the Department of Water and Power for water or electricity or sewage removal, but that's fine. We're going to kick out all the authorities, right? And then it's going to be time to construct a new set of authorities, and they don't have the capacity to do that without sort of, instead of referring to sort of postmodernism to help them construct the new set of powers or authorities, they have to go back, right? Not only did they go back to modernism, they, in a lot of ways, since they're walking around with like overlords now, they kind of went even pre-modern in some of this. And
they have feudal lords running around.
Yeah, they have feudal lords running around.
I'm so cynical that I think this is playing out of some would call cultural Marxism.
Yeah,
I think postmodernism is just a tool of cultural Marxism. It's there's this guy, I don't know, it was like mid-20th century, I think it was Theodore, and last name is Gramsci, wrote the Prison Notebooks, and he talks
Uwe just was published in the Wall Street Journal on him.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, he
this morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the mid-20th century...
Send me the article.
The failure of Marxism became pretty widely known. Right? you know, at least the Marxism that Karl Marx advocated in the Communist Manifesto. And then, so then the Marxists regroup and they still want the same ends of Marxism or socialism, but they got to take a different tact because they can't count on some sort of the workers uniting all across the world and overturning things. Instead, they're going to go do more of a bottom-up approach.
Institutional
and the long march through the institutions to change all the institutions. That especially includes the church and the university and everything else so that a socialist or a progressivist worldview becomes sort of the default view of things, and all this stuff seems normal now.
I mean, you've seen it.
Or it's not so shocking.
It's Antonio Gramsci.
Even an erasure of history that's happening here. I mean, the pulling down of statues all over the country. First, it started with Confederate symbols. Then it moved to, we have George Washington
Ulysses
pulled down
Grant.
In Portland. And then Grant, which is one of the most ironic ones since he helped liberate.
Yeah. They defaced the Vietnam Wall the other day. They bashed in, the Medal of Honor winner.
And
the,
a lot of...
The SEAL who was killed in Afghanistan calling in for support. Pretty high-profile case. They bashed that in.
And the interesting thing to me is you see sort of like, it's just chaos. They don't know what they're doing. They're just pulling down statues when they see statues. Or I think you see the kind of, it's getting rid of history so you can start fresh, which I think is probably making more sense.
Where I was going to go with this is that, none of this is expressly theological yet, right? This is in the politic. This is in the civic realm. This is in our civic lives. Except for to say that, this is a pretty good expression of man left to his own devices and how sort of the universal nature of sin will show itself here, which is all the more reason when you sort of leave this Civitas for a few hours on Sunday morning and make your way into the sanctuary, that to hear the message of the gospel at that point in time would be even more of a refuge, right, than it normally is. Because this is the uncomfortable, messy stuff that we deal with in this world that has a lot to do with what life will be like before we enter glory. But that's what it is, right? That is the dealing what this life will be like here while we're here on this sinful earth as sinners interacting with other sinners and our worries about that. Our worries about that for ourselves, for our children, for our grandchildren, and for future generations that we don't even know. Mm-hmm. But this is not necessarily. Now, there's some tie-ins, right? Because Adam talked about even Gramsci's sort of timed overtime attack, covert attack on institutions such as the church and his Christian belief in general, which talking to Bruce is one of the big tenets of postmodernism is to sort of tear down this icon of stability, which is Christianity, right? That's lasted for so long. But at the same time, is it then the church's job, not the individual Christian's job, the church, as we talk about church and state, the church's job to fight this? Because this is where I've come into most sort of clash with other Lutherans of our time, is that I actually don't think it's the role of the church, at least the church in America, right, as our sort of system is set up. It's not the role of the church to be the entity that changes this or to fight this. I would argue that it's the individual Christians, perhaps, but not the church as an institution or body.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons, and this is actually, I'm glad you did this because this is the way I wanted to transition.
It's like we think alike or something.
Is the concern that the church engaging in these particular political modes with the end that by informing regulation or even, law as the church, are you doing this or is it a part of making your neighbor or the outside world closer to being Christian? And if you can move people to ethically being, informed by the Decalogue, is that an apologetic mode to making them Christian if you can make the society morally, quote-unquote, Christian? Yeah, that seems to be.
I'm going to be on the other side of that one.
Mm-hmm.
we will, by doing that, encourage people to think they're more okay than they are. If we're doing it as institution, as church, such that their need for the gospel will be less, not more.
Because they think they're doing better.
Yep.
Yeah.
And in America, that goes really well.
Yeah, which is sort of where all these people are anyway, right? They're not doing it via the Decalogue. But if you even think about it, we don't necessarily, because of our political positions generally, think the things that they are doing are good, right? I.e. tearing down statues.
No.
Kind of like, but from a perspective, they think they are more moral than the people that came before them for doing it.
They do.
And are evangelically in a worse place because of that,
yes.
Is what right. Rod's saying. And I, yes. And it won't be so different if you convince them of sort of generic Christian morality that they now think they're achieving. In fact, you could probably, from a more theologically liberal position, convince them now that what they're doing is more spiritually effective than not doing anything.
Well, and the idea even from our perspective, that if everybody around us was just living more Christian, they'd be better off, is actually, you know, from the perspective of the right-hand kingdom and the perspective of Christians, not true. I mean, they might be better off
in this life.
A practical sense, right? certainly, but...
Well, as Rod said, in this life, or as right. I said, before your entrance into glory.
Yep.
But preaching the law for gain in this world is going to have some blur over... to preaching the law for gain in the next.
Adam, you look concerned.
No, I'm thinking.
Okay.
I just wonder, the church is a left-hand, in many ways, a left-hand kingdom institution.
Okay, so you mean administratively? So,
yeah.
And you don't mean like the church?
Yeah. So... I think, like, what about church-related institutions? I hate that phrase.
Okay, but, for the sake of the listeners, you're talking more like small C church here, mm-hmm. like a particular body, say like the LCMS or the Southern Baptist Convention, not like the church.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and to me it just seems, if it's up to the individual Christian to do this, that's basically where I am at. But good luck without any sort of organization.
Support.
I'm no central planner or anything like that. But
you are about to be a provost.
I mean, what about? So let's just, like, as a thought experiment.
Oh, well, let's do a thought experiment.
1517 is not a church,
correct?
Or a church-related institution
that's right.
Way, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Should it be combating? You are engaging in worldview-ish, ethical issues, political issues.
More so than it is,
yeah.
Or at all.
Yeah. I mean, I have no answers.
I think
these.
My bigger contention is that, say, a body that purports to exist for the purpose of, I'll just go with the Augsburg Confession definitions here, mm-hmm. preaching the gospel and rightly administering the sacraments, right?
Yeah.
That is, that's a very specific reason for existing, as in the church, the reason the church exists, right? That's what Augustana says.
Mm-hmm.
The church is that place where the gospel is preached and the sacraments are rightly administered. That's a different function than teaching the individual parishioners and or citizens within those church bodies to act this way or that politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I do think there is a role for institutions of, or even gatherings, right? Think tankery type mm-hmm. gatherings of individual Christians to come together and to help educate the laity to that end. And I think to some extent we do that. Now, our 1517's focus is a slightly more narrow in terms of generally being more gospel-oriented than politically-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is room mm-hmm. for institutions like 1517 that are more politically-oriented. Produce podcasts, websites, write books, mm-hmm. Articles, newspaper articles, you go down the line, TV shows, YouTube videos, whatever, down the line. I think that's all very helpful. I'm just wondering if that's the role of the church proper.
Yeah, yeah. No, it, yeah.
Well,
it
and
certainly
I think
isn't, but
I understand the tension you're getting at is like the church as a body or even a, you know, let's say in the United States, recognized by the IRS as a organization which exists and has a bunch of functions that then have political crossover, right? What if a church or a school or something for that matter gets sued? Do you just say, okay, we're ignoring this lawsuit. We're not a political thing. There's a divide between us and the state. No, you're going to have to lawyer up and
think of
the
issue
lawsuit.
Of abortion.
Right.
A hot button issue. I mean, does the church not say anything about that? I mean, not from the pulpit. I'm talking like in the school, in the ethics class or whatever.
Well, I even think from the pulpit, there's room to say something about it, right? Yeah. I mean, we would generally say that within preaching, both the law and the gospel need to be preached. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think within the realm of preaching the law, as an example of cultural sinfulness and even individual sin. It's fair game, for sure. But to go from that to saying, well, now you better vote for Trump because he's going to appoint conservative judges who will try to overturn Roe versus Wade, that's a bridge too far.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And I think that confusion, because I've been asked that, you know, you wouldn't even give room for a preacher to preach against abortion. And I'm like, well, of course I wouldn't say that. I mean, this is sin. Right, and within preaching about sin and the law, there's lots of latitude there. To bring up cultural sin, to bring up individual sin, to corporate culpability for inaction, all of that type of thing is fair game. But at the same time, to draw from that a distinct and specific political conclusion or remedy to that sin, I think too much.
But I was just thinking, like you said earlier, institutions. So Lutherans for Life, should they not exist?
I think they should. I think they absolutely should. Yeah. Absolutely.
But that's an organization like 1517 where it's not a church. So my point would be like, if my church, Prince of Peace Lutheran, went to a March for Life with banners that said Prince of Peace Lutheran Church on them and was walking around, my fear would be that people who, because there's opposition protests to all these things, right, who see those signs will never hear Christ from Prince of Peace Lutheran Church ever again, right? They're an enemy. We are at war with each other now. And we're called to go proclaim Christ to sinners.
Let me say this. This is interesting that you brought up this example because Autumn and I.
This isn't a big issue for me. I was just thinking.
Well, it is a big issue for me. Autumn and I were driving the other day, and she said, "You know, I just and just let me clarify. She's a Christian, right? She believes abortion's wrong on multiple levels here, but she said, "You know, I just don't get it. I think there's a much better secular scientific argument against abortion than theological one, and I wish Christians would drop the theological one and just start making the scientific, rational, sort of secular one. I think we'd make more progress."
In the public sphere.
In the public sphere, I think we'd make more progress on this issue. And I'm like, yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. So in that sense, you know, I think Lutherans for Life should exist, but I think as much progress could be made towards the eventual end if just more Lutherans would get involved in, less specifically religious objections to abortion and make a civil argument against
it. Well, and I even think,
you as a citizen in this country are afforded certain protections in this country that unborn children should be afforded as well. That's not a religious argument.
Yep.
Right.
That's a civil liberties argument, right?
And I think
this isn't a person.
Yeah.
Show a 3D ultrasound.
The church and its institution has done pretty... I don't want to be like some judgy judger, but we've done pretty poorly in entering the public arena.
Yes.
And arguing on the grounds that people in the public arena, your opponents, will actually listen to you.
Well, you're walking around to a bunch of people who don't believe with Bible verses.
You've sinned against God, a God you don't believe in.
And I'm like, how effective is this at the end of the day? And I guess that's my bigger...
Yeah, I mean, I think that this opens up a whole bunch of things, doors, but we have a pretty low view of reason.
Yeah,
a deep anti-intellectualism.
Yeah,
Mark Knoll said all of evangelicalism suffers from this. That the scandal of the evangelical mind is that it doesn't have a...
David Wells.
Is that David Wells? Okay.
I think part of this, too, when it comes to these big issues like abortion or is that a lot of it focuses, let's say, on federal and national level, even with institutions like
that's getting real
Lutherans
deep.
For Life. Well, my point would be is that at the vocational level, if you're a church...
you're going concentric circles.
Right, and you're preaching this kind of thing and you're encouraging people to do something about it because you said people don't organize themselves, right? And you're preaching against it and somebody asks you, what can you do? Well, there's actually probably local things you can point them to. You can talk to people about, you know, women's and children's shelters and adoption. I mean, there's have been states where or cities too where they've zoned out abortion clinics out of their cities and things like that through public planning and options.
Well, this
things
goes,
in the civil realm where vocationally, actually, as a citizen of the United States, you have certain abilities, political abilities, to get involved and do that over there.
Well, and the idea of vocation very much supports the fact that you have more opportunity to serve those neighbors who whom God has placed in your life closer to you rather than farther away, right? Mm-hmm. And this is... We look over that. It's not as glorious.
Yeah. Yep.
It's not as glorious to counsel the individual woman who's scared and terrified and doesn't know what to do with this emergency in her life. That's harder and less, you know, glorified than doing something else, you know, on a grander political stage. Yeah. And I think we got to keep track of that.
Yeah, it's easy to get mad at a senator being elected in a state that you don't even reside in, who's, you know, pro-choice.
While your state.
While there might be, you know, somebody living five doors down from you who's contemplating getting an abortion tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Or under your own roof.
Right. In some cases. So, that's interesting. So the way we should wrap this up on maybe a lighter
note probably wrap it up with some summary conclusions. We've been traversing the landscape.
There is a balance here to be drawn with distinctions between the proclamation of the gospel and vocation. And vocation actually is wide, right? Because people are called to many different areas. So you have vocation as a citizen. You have maybe a vocation if you're in a political position as a pastor to preach against certain things, but also to deliver the forgiveness of sins. And that's where this sort of comes down is what are you called to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, called to serve your neighbor freely. Huh. And that's the thing we can't get off of, right? The idea of justification is that you're now free from the obligation to do this out of fear of your eternal damnation. I mean, God in Christ has taken this on to himself, has died and raised again on the third day as the first fruits of your resurrection. You in him, you are justified, you are saved, you are free. And now as a free Christian, you are free to love those people whom he has put in your life, and that love is expressed in free service to them.
Yep. Nice summary.
Well, great, guys. So we're going to wrap up this episode. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support the show, there's two... really easy and beneficial ways you can do that. The first is go 1517.org/donate. If you have the ability, I know many people have been hit financially hard during these times, but if you have the ability or you've been considering it, you can go there and you can set up a small recurring donation. Those go to support the podcast network and the other projects at 1517, and we greatly appreciate that. The other thing you can do is you can go to the Apple Podcasting app. I will put a link in there. You can access it via any internet browser if you don't use Apple products, and you could leave us a short 5-star review. Those help increase our ability to be searched and accessed from people, not just on the Apple Podcasting app, but on many platforms, as the majority of podcasting platforms pull Apple's library of shows into their platform. So you can go ahead and do that, and that helps us greatly. And I actually think Spotify Podcasts has upped their game as well. So if you are a Spotify listener, you can rate the show on there as well, and that would help us reach a whole new audience in this new platform. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.